morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. My name is Ann Gardner. I'm a justice on this court, and to my right is Justice Bill Meyer. He's a justice on this court also. And to my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. And we constitute the panel for this morning's cases. I want to take this opportunity to welcome you, the senior government class of Bethesda Christian School. And Mr. Wood, or Professor Wood, is that you back there? Welcome. We're glad to have you here and hope that you aren't totally bored and that you enjoy the morning, and maybe there's at least one among you who is a future lawyer who will be inspired by this morning's proceedings. We're going to have one oral argument right now, and then we will recess when this argument is concluded, and I believe that Chief Justice Livingston has arranged to take you on a tour of our offices. And then we have two more oral arguments scheduled starting at 10:30, and it's my understanding that y'all are going to come back to listen to the second oral argument. Okay, we'll reconvene at 10:30 in here. So with that, and I won't take up the lawyer's time by making any introductory comments about the history of this court and who we are. We can do that after they've finished. There'll be a few minutes before you can go out, and Justice Livingston will be waiting for you in the lobby. So with that beginning and welcome again, we will begin our proceedings. And I will ask the deputy clerk to call the first case.
The court calls Hannon Inc. versus Ronnie Scott. May it please the court, Ms. Annette Banachek will represent the appellant, and Mr. Jeremy Sorrell will represent the athlete.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Annette Banachek, representing the appellant in this case, Hannon Incorporated, who was the plaintiff below in the trial court. I'd like to briefly go through the basic facts of our case, and then I would like to address the points of error that we've raised in our brief that was filed several weeks ago. This case arises from the sale of a business enterprise called Dollarland, which was located on East Belknap Street here in Fort Worth. My client was the owner of that business and owned the trade fixtures, as well as leased the premises from a landlord and had various amounts of inventory that was sold in the fashion of a dollar store. Most of the merchandise was sold at a dollar per unit in that prospect. My client, or one of the owners of my client, became ill with a kidney disease requiring a kidney transplant, and it was determined that the business would need to be sold. My client listed the property for sale in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the local newspaper, and was approached by a Elizabeth Scott, who is not named as a defendant but is the spouse of Ronnie Scott, the named defendant in this case. The Scotts came to the store, investigated, observed, spent several weeks back and forth discussing the possibility of purchasing the store with my client's representative, Mr. Aziz Hannon. It was ultimately determined at the end of May in 2004 that the Scotts would be willing to purchase the store for the sum of $80,000. The contract of sale, which is entered into evidence as plaintiff's exhibit, I believe number one, indicates that the assets of Dollarland were being purchased were the trade fixtures and the inventory. And the basic breakdown was that trade fixtures were approximately $53,000 or $54,000, and the inventory was approximately $30,000. The Scotts agreed to pay approximately $40,000 down. There was an earnest money of $2,500, and at the closing there would be an additional sum of $37,500 paid. The balance of the purchase price, which would be $40,000, was paid over a 10-month time period and would be paid at 6% per annum. These documents are also as exhibits plaintiff's exhibits 2, 3, and 4 in the record. At the time the Scotts purchased the store, Mrs. Scott indicated that she had experience managing another franchise, a Dollar General store in the area, and had been involved in retailing for several years. During the time period of the Scotts' investigation, they were given access to the store. They were welcome to observe. They were allowed to ask questions, get information, do various things to determine whether or not this was an investment opportunity that they were able to fulfill. When the closing was scheduled at the end of June of 2004, the Scotts came in, signed the contract documents, that is the promissory note, the security interests, and also paid the balance of the down payment, the $37,500. They were also given an opportunity to re-execute a lease with the landlord for the existing location. They also were given the information on the various vendors that Hannon Inc. was doing business with as far as food products, phone cards, which are sold in the dollar stores, things of that nature. Essentially, on the 1st of July, after the Scotts had gotten their sales tax permit, the store was delivered to them with the trade fixtures and the existing inventory. You might also note in the record that the Scotts also took an inventory at the time of their purchase to indicate the amount of inventory available for sale, and it came out within a few hundred dollars of $30,000 by their own count. The Scotts endeavored to start business selling the inventory on the store. The only fatal flaw in the Scotts' business plan is they did not have the funds or ability to buy new inventory. They had not secured a source of funding for purchasing new inventory to replenish the shelves of the store. And within a few months, that is by November of 2004, they had not only defaulted on the payments to Hannon Inc., they had essentially closed the store and either sold or abandoned the fixtures for a very, very low price. That is, I think the testimony in the record was approximately $3,000. The Hannon Inc. Essentially brought the lawsuit in the 141st Judicial District Court to collect on the balance due of the note. And the Scotts then counterclaimed, alleging fraud. After a one-day non-jury trial before the bench, the court took the matter under advisement. The trial was held in October of 2008, and on February 13, 2009, Judge Wade, who was the presiding judge in the 141st at that time, entered a one-page order, which is part of the appendix that is attached to our brief. And essentially, he adopted all of the requested findings of fact proposed by the defendant in this case. After judgment was entered, a motion for new trial was filed by my client, and Judge Chupp, who was a successor judge in the 141st, granted in part that motion for new trial, amended the judgment to address some of the items that were not supported by the evidence, and thereafter a second motion for new trial was filed, and that ultimately was denied, leading to this appeal. Essentially, in this case, we have the plaintiff's claim, that is, Hannon's claim for breach of contract, and we have the Scott's defense that there was a fraud committed in the sale of the business enterprise. The first three points of error that are addressed in our brief address the affirmative claims that Hannon Inc. raised and presented evidence on in the trial court, and essentially these were not disputed by the plaintiff. That is, they signed the documents, they agreed to pay $40,000 as a down payment and finance the balance over the 10-month period reflected in the promissory note. All of those documents that would establish a valid breach of contract claim on behalf of Hannon were not essentially contested by the defendant. The defendant's main claim is that they were allegedly defrauded, and therefore the contract itself was void and unenforceable against them.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
It looks like one of the matters that is disputed is whether certain, I don't know what you would call them, things were not included, like helium tanks, Western Union money order machines, ice cream freezer, two large Coke coolers, and a large Coke display. Were those part of the trade fixtures, or were those removable items that were excluded from the contract?
Those were removable items. On the contract of sale, there's an attachment that lists the various trade fixtures, the number of shelving or the linear feet of shelving, and those items belong to the vendors for which you would sell, for instance, the phone cards. The helium tanks are there on a lease agreement for balloons to be sold, things of that nature. And those were not included on the list attached to the contract of sale and therefore were not included in the trade fixtures sold under the contract.
Well, was there a listing of the trade fixtures that were included?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe those are attached. I don't recall the exact exhibit number from the plaintiff's perspective, but there was a one-page listing with a total valuation of approximately $53,000 as the value of those trade fixtures. The trial court's findings with respect to the fraud claim are erroneous in this case for various reasons. The first of which is that the defendants, in this case the Scotts, did not establish any kind of justifiable reliance in this case. They were given...
Can I get you to go back to the point you just discussed? In the proposed, in the findings of fact that's adopted by the court, it says that the contents were included in the purchase of the business and that the contents was from the storeroom, the showroom vault.
That's
part of the contract, isn't it?
That's the finding by the court, but the contract does not expressly state that, Your Honor.
Well, I'm talking about the court's findings. We're looking at them just like they were jury findings. I'm asking you if there was evidence that was testified to by the purchaser was that he thought he was supposed to be getting everything in the store from the storefront, from the storefront forward.
That point was controverted at trial. What I believe the testimony of Mr. Scott was that he thought he was getting that. Mrs. Scott understood that there were contracts for various vendors, including the helium tank, the Coca-Cola, the ice cream. Those were refrigeration units that were on lease from the vendors.
My concern is that I've read your brief and I've read your contentions, and I'm hearing you tell us about those again this morning. But in terms of the court's findings, if there's any evidence to support the findings, any evidence, meaning anything more than a scintilla of evidence to support the findings, so that we don't have a no evidence situation, then it's your burden on the appeal as the appellant to show that there was no evidence to support these findings. And I'm not hearing you do that in what you said in your brief or what you said here this morning so far.
In the, I believe, the evidence at trial, there, Mrs. Scott was as not a non-party but a spouse of a party, I believe had some testimony that she understood about the vendor contracts not being included. The actual contract itself does not include any of the listing of the items that Mr. Scott, who was not directly involved in much of the observations the Scotts made prior to purchase, testify that he thought it was, even including the items that were in the back, which were not something they ever complained about.
I'm not being clear with my question to you, and I'm sorry, I apologize. Mr. Scott testified that he believed that the items included were everything from the storefront. So that's some evidence that all is included. If the court is going by the rule of law that we're to follow, which is that if there's any evidence to support the trial court's findings, they were to go with the trial court's findings. And I don't understand how you're saying that what Mr. Scott said was no evidence, because he did testify to that. I read the record.
Yes, Your Honor, he did testify that he thought everything was included in the store. I think the thrust of our point is it was not reasonable for him to rely on that representation given all of the other circumstances and the opportunities he had to investigate not only what the document actually said, but also the financial status of the and the information that he alleges he was requesting.
Well, I guess I'm just asking you if it's your position that his testimony amounts to no evidence in spite of the fact that it appears in the record in a question and answer session in the court reporter's record.
I can't say, Your Honor, that it's no evidence. I think it it was heavily controverted even by witnesses offered by the Scotts themselves, that is, Mrs. Scott.
Apparently Judge Wade didn't believe it.
I can't say, since I'm not Judge Wade, but according to his...
in his findings of fact. Anyway, thank you for answering my question.
Yes, Your Honor. The two major points on the fraud claim is the reasonable diligence that the Scotts failed to exercise in investigating the situation that they were getting involved in, and their clear lack of preparation in making an investment for a retail enterprise when they, in fact, had no qualifications or experience in doing so. Both of the Scotts testified that they never sought an attorney, they never sought an accountant, they never investigated through use of professionals. They never insisted on the financial information that they assert was required before they would actually close. They, in fact, closed and paid money before they realized, according to Mr. Scott, that he hadn't gotten the financial information that he says he requested. The last point I think that's important for the fraud claim is that the trial court erred in assessing the damages it made in this case. There was no ability, based on what the Scotts did, for any recognition of the value they received. By the Scotts' own testimony, there was $30,000 in inventory that they received when they paid the $40,000 at the closing of the contract. There's no dispute that they received that, but there's no recognition of that value in the court's calculations. Also, there's no calculation of the value of the trade fixtures that were delivered and given to the Scotts at the time they opened the store, and that was undisputed at approximately $53,000 or $54,000. The Scotts failed to take any effort at all to try to preserve the value of those trade fixtures. They essentially liquidated them for a garage sale value to somebody for $3,000 at a flea market.
Their testimony was that they let the Hannons know that those fixtures were there and that they should come pick them up.
And Mr. Hannon testified that he had never received that, even though he was in communications with them for collecting the NSF check that was delivered by the Scotts to the Hannon, I believe sometime in October of 2004. And the fact that they were closing was not information that my client ever received from them, other than delivery of the NSF check. My time is concluded. I'll step back.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jeremy Sorrell. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Scotts. I think I can probably take this point by point, be pretty concise, and wrap this up pretty quickly. The first two contentions that appellant makes, in regards to the breach of contract in issue number one, it was never conclusively established at trial that, in fact, the Scotts breached the contract, but rather that they were forced into the situation of a breach based upon the fraud. That was the judge's findings in the trial court. As to issue number two, the liability to Hannon for the payment provided in the contract, again, the trial court found that there was no entitlement to recover any of that because of the contract and the entire situation actually being wrought in fraud. And since there couldn't be a conclusive finding of the breach of contract, they would not be entitled to recover any of those monies due at that time, nor the attorney's fees. Which is issue number three, the recovery of the attorney's fees. On to issue four from appellant's brief. The trial court erred in finding that Hannon made false material misrepresentations. Well, actually, the trial court found that there were indeed many false misrepresentations that were material to this case. In fact, Mr. Hannon had held out the earnings of the store, the potential earnings, what he had been making, which was found to be false. That obviously would be material in making the decision whether to contract or not, if you believed what those earnings were. He provided the Scotts with the documentation to take to the bank in order to secure some financing. Those numbers were also found by the trial court to be false. And in making a decision to purchase a business, those things were found by the trial court to be material.
Can you address the fact that they never got to look at the books?
I can. In the trial court's record, you'll find testimony that they had asked for the books. They were sent to Mr. Hannon's accountant. While they were there, they signed a memorandum anticipating that they were going to receive the books to look at them. They later found out that the memorandum they signed was not actually a memorandum in anticipation of the actual contract, but were told, that is the contract, you've signed it, and a demand for money was made at that moment. Again, the trial court's record will show that they believed at that point and testified that they felt obligated to that contract because they had signed it, even though at the time of signing they did not know that was the actual contract, another material misrepresentation as found by the trial court. At that point, believing that they were locked into the contract, these are not highly sophisticated people, so they believed at that point they just had to go on with the transaction, and so did not receive the actual books until after the contracts were signed. Let's see, on to issue 5, the trial court erred in finding Hannon's representations made, representatives made false representations. Again, the trial court's record is wrought with testimony all throughout based upon what the inventory actually was, how much inventory was there, when it was actually counted by the Scotts, it was less. The fact that everything from the storeroom forward was included in the transaction, when the Scotts later found out that indeed some of those items were not, including the helium balloons, the soda machines, the ice cream machines, which were things that they did not know until, obviously, again, after they were involved in the contract, and the vendors came in and removed these items. As to issue 6, the trial court erred in finding that Hannon's representatives made false representations with intent to induce the Scotts. Again, going back to the trial record, there's testimony in there that they intentionally disclosed wrong financials to them. The letter that they gave them to secure financing was false. I don't know how that could be anything other than intentional, and I don't believe the trial court would disagree with me on that. Intentionally misled them to believe that they were receiving all of the items from the back storeroom forward, which obviously they did not. There was also testimony that they were intentionally told that there were other buyers that immediately had to, they had to make a decision today, that things had to be done. That also was in the trial court's record. If they didn't purchase it now, they would lose the property. Also, there was the issue with one of the co-owners of Hannon having a surgery. At the trial court level, no evidence was brought forward to support that contention. We don't know if that actually ever happened or not. At this point, we would contend that that was a misrepresentation, that that was intentionally brought upon the Scotts to induce them to purchase. As to issue 7, the trial court erred in finding that the Scotts actually unjustifiably relied upon the statements. They requested the documents and also received the letter from Mr. Hannon to take to the bank. I think if Mr. Hannon was willing to put down in writing something for them to take to a financial institution, they justifiably relied on the fact that those were correct numbers.
There was some issue in the brief about whether that letter was in
There was justice. That issue was never actually brought up at trial as to the cut and pasting as it was mentioned in the appeal. I scoured the record and could not find anything relating to the fact that there was a possible forgery or a cut and paste of the signature. That was something that actually was not anywhere in the trial court's record or discussed at all. As to issue number 8, the trial court erred in finding that Scott suffered injury as a result of Hannon's conduct because such findings are against the great weight of the and preponderance of the evidence. I would just respectfully disagree with that. There was testimony all throughout that the trial court found significant injuries based upon the misrepresentations by Hannon. Financial injuries, they lost their home because of the quick sale to try to secure the property.
And they didn't lose their home, counsel. They sold their home and turned the proceeds over as part of the down payment.
They sold their home in a short sale at a significant loss.
Instead of $48,000.
Correct.
But they didn't lose it. They sold it and turned the money over as part of the sales price.
I stand corrected, Justice. They did sell it. They sold it in a short sale to gain the money. So they would have, in effect, lost the other amounts of equity had they been able to set on it on the market. They also, because the numbers were incorrect, they were forced to use money out of their own pockets. Mr. Scott has had a full-time job at that time. He was actually paying the bills for the Dollar Land store. Justice, I actually did not litigate this case at the trial court level. I didn't produce any of the pleadings.
Of the defendant has asked for special or consequential damages.
To my knowledge, they did not.
So how are these damages that were reported, how are they proper damages in a fraud claim? Because they're definitely not out-of-pocket expenses by the traditional damages model of what's awarded for out-of-pocket expenses. They're not benefit of the bargain damages. So how is things like the money that they lost on the short sale of their house, how is that a proper damage award in a fraud case? How is that foreseeable by the plaintiff?
Well, I believe it would be foreseeable as Mr. Hannon actually had the knowledge prior to the sale where the money would be coming from, that they would have to be selling their house in order to get the down payment. So he actually testified that to the fact – he testified actually to the fact that he was not aware of that. However, the Scotts testified to the fact that they did give him that knowledge and he knew that and that it was foreseeable. The pleading
Well, he sell it and get money to pay him, but that they're going to actually lose money. He's supposed to foresee that.
Right, based upon the fact that there was fraud involved. He would foresee that he hadn't given them accurate numbers and that what the store was actually had in inventory and was making was substantially less than he had held out to them, and so it was extremely foreseeable, as the trial court found, that they would lose money. That I'm afraid we would have to ask the trial court judge. He took it upon himself to award these damages.
You're here to support it and to defend it. And so my question is of you. I don't have
obviously. Because those damages were foreseeable, because they disclosed fully to Mr. Hannon where their financial situation was and where the money would be coming from to help support the business as they went along. He was fully aware. Not only was it foreseeable, but he knew where the money would be coming from to help support that.
Okay, but this isn't the money that they paid him.
Correct.
This is the money that they lost because they had to sell the house quickly. I mean, the same question goes to the unpaid utility bills. or the amount of his salary that he put into the business. I'm trying to find out how those are proper damages under any traditional damage model for a fraud case.
Well, I would assume that they would not be traditional damages unless pled for and awarded in such a way that was not pled for in this case.
So are you conceding you didn't plead for them, so you shouldn't get them?
Well, I would maintain that we actually, I'm not going to stand up here and make up something. No, they weren't pled for, and whether or not they should have been received was based on the decision of the trial court judge. He awarded those damages. And I can't speak for him. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sorrell. Ms. Banachek, do you have a rebuttal?
Your Honors, I'd like to just address a few quick points that were raised in the comments made with the appellee. Mr. Aziz Hannon did testify with respect to the plaintiff's exhibit number 11, the alleged, this is the financial information regarding the store, that he had never seen that before attending a mediation with the appellee post-trial. He did not sign it. It was not his signature. When you match the signatures up, they look identical to what's on the contract of sale that he did sign on behalf of Hannon, Inc. at the closing. With respect to the damages, and I think this is where the conclusions of law made by the trial court are erroneous, the recognition of the damages, even if you believe that my client committed fraud, misrepresented everything, the question comes back to what are the damages for that fraud? Take away reliance, take away those issues, and let's get down to what the money involved is. What did the Scotts get when they paid the money to my client? They got an operating store. They got $30,000 worth of inventory. They got $50-some thousand dollars worth of trade fixtures in that process. They operated the store. They collected revenues by their own count and their own records. They sold that inventory and kept the profits. If you're going to do a rescission damage, where is the reduction in the amount to?
Is there anything in the judgment or the finding about rescission? Because I didn't find it. I went back and looked for it.
Your Honor, it's not obvious. What essentially, if you look at the damage models, the Scotts get their money back, the $37,500 that they paid, the $24,500 they paid on the earnest money. They got these other items of special damages, which have their own problems as far as legal theories. But if you give back, if you want to get back with your money, that's a rescission remedy. It's not the difference in value of what was represented to you. It's a we want our money back, and that, by definition, is a rescissionary or restitutionary type of theory. No, they did not. And in this process, the damage model awarded by the court reflects the Scotts wanting to back out 6 months after the fact and not give credit for what they were actually receiving under the transaction that they had with Hannon, Inc. Ultimately, they could not give back what they received because they liquidated the trade fixtures and received only $3,000. So my client could not come back in, obtain those trade fixtures, either reopen the store, reinvest inventory, or do what they needed to do to recognize a higher amount for those. Going back and then... Yes.
I'm going back to the judge's findings again, okay? And the judge's findings are that upon closing the doors, it sold the inventory to an individual for $4,000, not the trade fixture.
Yes.
And it says that there was notice given to Mr. Hannon that he could take... repossess and take possession again of the trade fixtures, which he refused, which he didn't do. That's the trial judge's findings of fact.
I understand, Your Honor.
You're just saying that in spite of that, our evidence was different, and therefore the judge shouldn't have found it.
With respect to the trade fixtures, Your Honor, they did admit they sold it. With respect to the inventory, they say they sold it in the store and closed the doors without selling it to the third-party individual.
They admitted that, but the trial judge's findings of fact are different, and the evidence in the records that they did was that it was contested about the fact. Ms. Scott testified was she went over and talked to Mr. Hannon and told him the store was closed, they could get the fixtures.
But not the inventory, because the inventory...
The inventory was sold for $4,000.
I believe in the record it says that the trade fixtures were sold for $4,000. It did not mention inventory.
I'm going to read you. It's finding 14. Upon closing the doors, the Scotts sold the inventory to an individual for approximately $4,000.
And, Your Honor, my recollection from the record and the testimony in the case was that the trade fixtures were sold for $4,000 and not the inventory. That is the findings, and if the court will look to see what was submitted wholesale at the time of trial in the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, the findings entered by the court on the 13th of February are identical. Though these proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law were not submitted at the time the judge entered his order. They were actually submitted in blank as a proposed set of findings at the time of trial, which would be before testimony was actually taken in the case. My time is concluded. We'd ask the court to reverse the trial judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Vanacek. Thank you, Mr. Sorrell. Thank you both for your arguments, and we appreciate your briefs. Your case is submitted, and you are excused.